briefly review the passages, the scriptures that are most basic to this subject, and tell us what it was that the ancients were required to do as they observed the Passover. Of course, you know the story. Exodus 12 and the preceding chapters, we know that the Israelites were in Egypt. They were in bondage under Pharaoh's rule. And they were, well, they were servants. They were slaves in Egypt. And they were preparing to leave because God had made a promise long ago to Abraham that he would give his seed, his descendants, the land that he showed to Abraham, the land we know as Palestine, the land of the Canaanites at that time. So God said he would give to Abraham and his descendants after him that land. And then God allowed those descendants to grow into a great multitude in Egypt. They were there because they had fled. Jacob and his sons had fled a famine that was in the land of promise. So the time came when God decided to bring them out of the land of Egypt and take them to the land of promise so that they could establish the kingdom, the nation that God had promised that he would make through the descendants of Abraham. So we come to the point where several plagues had fallen upon Egypt, and God was conditioning the Egyptians through these plagues to release the Israelites from bondage and permit them to go into the land of promise, to leave and go into the wilderness where they would worship God and ultimately into the land of promise. Of course, you know, they took the long way around to get there because of rebellion in the wilderness. But Exodus 12 takes us up to that point where they were about to leave. It takes us to the last plague that befell Egypt by a result of through a divine miracle. It was the Passover. It was the time when the death angel, as we call it, death, passed through the land of Egypt. And God said that every firstborn will die except for those who have a certain mark on their doorposts and the lintels of their homes. And we read about that in Exodus 12. Let's begin reading there in verse 3. Speak to the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, talking about the first month of the year, every man shall take for himself a lamb according to the house of his fathers, a lamb for a household. And it goes on to give instructions about that, if the household is too small and so forth. Verse 5, your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. And you, when you read about other sacrifices later on, you notice that the male lambs or goats or whatever animal is being offered must be without blemish because God expects the best when an offering is given to him. And certainly it represents an act of worship by giving him the best. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. Now you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight, as this translation says, or at even, as others say, or in the evening, as other translations say. And this is from the Hebrew Ben Ha'arbiyim. And, of course, that's the subject of quite a bit of controversy. Some of the ancients claimed that, literally translated, it does mean between the two evenings. And it definitely talks about the latter part of the day, but some of the ancients thought it began at sundown, and the first evening was at sundown, the second evening was at dark. And others said, no, the first evening is in the afternoon, about 3 o'clock. Second evening is at about 6 o'clock. In any case, that was a controversy, and of course, later on in the time of Christ, we can see that how it was being observed at that time and how his death aligned with the latter reckoning. But continuing on here, verse 7, and they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses where they eat. Then they shall eat the flesh on that night, roasted in fire, with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs they shall eat it. Then he goes on to give some instructions on how to prepare it, about the nature of the observance. Then in verse 12 he says, for I will pass through the land of Egypt on that night and will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, against all the gods of Egypt, the mighty ones of Egypt. I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. Now the blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you, hence the name Passover. And the plague shall not be on you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. So this day shall be to you a memorial, and you shall keep it as a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. You shall keep it as a feast by an everlasting ordinance. And then he goes on and gives instructions concerning the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the seven-day feast that follows this sacrificial rite, the Passover. And it continues in verse 24. And you shall observe this thing as an ordinance for you and your sons forever. In other words, this was not something that was to be done only one time in the land of Egypt. It was to be repeated year after year at the same season because they were to remember this event. It seems that we as human beings have a tendency to forget things too quickly, don't we? So God, knowing this, wanted the Israelites to continue to offer this sacrifice year after year in memory of that event. So they would always keep before them the knowledge of who it was that brought them out of Egypt, who it was that gave them the promised land, who it was that blessed them, and so on. Verse 25, it will come to pass when you come to the land which the Lord will give you, just as he promised, that you shall keep this service. So you see, it was to go even in the land, not only in the wilderness. We do know that in the second year in the wilderness, Scripture tells us they observed it. I don't know how many times after that, while they were in their 40 years of wilderness sojourning, that they observed it, but definitely in the second year, perhaps other times as well. But here he talks about when they come into the land. When you come into the land which the Lord will give you, just as he promised, that you shall keep this service. And it shall be when your children say to you, what do you mean by this service? That you shall say, it is the Passover sacrifice of the Lord, who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt when he struck the Egyptians and delivered our households. So the people bowed their heads and worshipped. So in other words, this is a memorial of the Exodus. And specifically, they were to remember that event, that last plague that befell Egypt, and how God protected them, how death passed over them. And this event in Egypt caused Pharaoh to change his mind and allow the people to go. So this was a memorial of the Exodus. So that's the basic instructions for the Passover, especially it was given originally in Egypt there when they came into the land, and we'll look at that in a few moments. But there were some modifications made because they were in a new set of circumstances. But what if you had been an Israelite in that land? Well, if you had been an Israelite in that land, you would have done precisely what these instructions here tell you. What if you... Now, we're told later that when the people of Israel actually did depart Egypt, that a mixed multitude went out with them. In other words, other people, not descendants of Jacob or Abraham, Isaac, not Israelites. They went out with them. Perhaps some of the Egyptians... We know that some of the Egyptians themselves went out. Other people who had come into the land of Egypt due to famines in their regions undoubtedly were among this mixed multitude, and they went out with the Egyptians. Now suppose that you were there with the Israelites, you left Egypt with them, now you're out in the wilderness, and it's coming up on the second year, and they're preparing to keep the Passover and remember what God had done for them back in Egypt. And you want to be a part of it because you saw what God did and you know that he is the true God. What must you do? Well, we have the instructions right here in chapter 12. Continue in verse 43. And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, this is the ordinance of the Passover. No foreigner shall eat it. In other words, it's for Israelites. No foreigner shall eat it. But every man's servant who is bought for money, when you have circumcised him, then he may eat it. A sojourner and a hired servant shall not eat it. In one house it shall be eaten. You shall not carry any of the flesh outside the house, nor shall you break one of its bones. All the congregation of Israel shall keep it. And when a stranger, now here's the answer, when a stranger, that means one who is not a native-born Israelite, when a stranger dwells with you and wants to keep the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised, and then let him come near and keep it. And he shall be as a native of the land, for no uncircumcised person shall eat it. One law shall be for the native-born and for the stranger who dwells among you. Now, this does not mean, understand this, this does not mean if the Israelites are, whether in the wilderness or in the land, and then foreigners come in, And they say, you know, we appreciate what you guys are doing here. And we know about how God delivered you from Egypt, and we would like to celebrate this thing with you. May we eat the Passover? And of course, in order for them to do that, as it says here, they had to submit to the rite of circumcision. And then they could eat it. This does not mean that then that they could say, well, we'll see you next year, Passover time. In the meantime, we're going back to our native lands and worship idols. Not what it's talking about here. No, what it means is you become, by being grafted in, as it were, an Israelite, if you wish to keep the Passover. And it's strictly forbidden that anyone who is uncircumcised of the males of a household are not to keep the Passover. Okay? Now, what about regulations for the Passover once the Israelites got into the land of promise? As I mentioned, there were some changes made. There were some adaptations made because now they're in a new environment, a new set of circumstances. Turn with me to Deuteronomy 16 and let's look at some of those things, some of the differences between the Passover as it was to be observed in the land of promise and the Passover as it was observed in ancient Egypt. Deuteronomy 16 and beginning in verse 1, observe the month of Abib. It's also known as the month of Nisan. It's the same month, the first month of the year. And keep the Passover to the Lord your God, for in the month of Abib the Lord your God brought you out of Egypt by night. Therefore you shall sacrifice the Passover to the Lord your God from the flock and the herd in the place where the Lord chooses to put his name. Now this has been troubling to some people. It says from the flock and the herd, meaning the cattle. But how can you have a sacrifice of the Passover from the cattle? Well, apparently, by this time, of course, you know, as time goes on, language evolves, terms evolve. And here, when it's speaking of the Passover, it's not only speaking of that sacrificial rite that we read about back in Exodus 12, but it's also apparently, the best we can tell from this, talking about that season of the year, the entire festival of unleavened bread. And each one of those sacrifices offered during that season was a Passover sacrifice. But now the Passover sacrifice, the one involving the lamb, was the one that was offered first and was unique and stood out from the others. The others were peace offerings and things of that nature. But this one stood out, the one Passover sacrifice that we read about in Exodus 12, it stands out from the others. But now, there's a difference in the land than there was in Egypt. A difference, something has changed here. Now they have a functional priesthood. Now they have a central place of worship, a tabernacle, later became a temple. And here's what the instructions are in this new environment. So you shall, skipping on to verse 3, you shall eat no leavened bread with it 7 days. Well, with it, you eat this Passover for 7 days. It must be talking about those other sacrifices as a part of the Passover season. They were Passover sacrifices, in effect. Goes on to say, that is the bread of affliction, for you came out from the land of Egypt in haste, that you may remember the day in which you came out of the land of Egypt all the days of your life. And no leaven shall be seen among you in all your territory for 7 days, nor shall any of the meat which you sacrifice the first day at twilight remain overnight until morning. You may not sacrifice the Passover within any of your gates which the Lord your God gives you. This is a difference right here. You know, in Egypt, they were to sacrifice at their individual homes. Here it says, you may not sacrifice the Passover within any of your gates which the Lord your God gives you. Not in individual homes. But at the place where the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide, there you shall sacrifice the Passover at twilight, at the going down of the sun, at the time you came out of Egypt. And you shall roast and eat it where the Lord your God chooses. It goes on and reiterates the 6 days of unleavened bread following this initial Passover sacrifice, the 7 days, actually, but 6 days here, but seven altogether, following the initial sacrifice of the Passover. So here the Passover was to be done in a central location, not in individual homes. Now, some people say that there were allowances made. I don't know. The way I read this chapter here, the Passover was a part of the sacrificial system that was based in Jerusalem, ultimately, at the central sanctuary, and therefore had to be offered in Jerusalem. So, from all of this, we put it all together, just for a brief review of what we see so far, we can conclude this. The Passover was a sacrificial rite, just like the other sacrifices. It was a sacrificial rite. Number two, it was a memorial of the Exodus. Number three, it was, or I can say it is, either way you want to put it, for Israelites only, meaning for the circumcised only. The foreigners were absolutely forbidden to eat it if they remained uncircumcised. In fact, if we were living in ancient Israel and we were having observing the Passover and eating the sacrificial lamb, and we had friends who came from another land and they were friendly toward us, and they even worshipped and believed in our God, if they were uncircumcised, it would be a sin for them to eat it. It would be a sin for us to offer it to them. So it was for Israelites only. Number four, it was to be observed in one place. When they got into the land, one central place. And not in every place scattered all over. Now, point number five, I want you to turn with me to Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews chapter 10, just one verse here. He's talking in context about the sacrifices in the Old Testament. He says, chapter 10, verse 1, "For the law, having a shadow of the good things to come, and not the very image of the things, can never with these same sacrifices, which they offer continually, year by year, make those who approach perfect." Now, he has specifically in mind here, if you read the whole context, the sin offerings, but includes the whole sacrificial system. That would also include the Passover sacrifice. So the sacrifices in the law served as a shadow of the good things to come, meaning the redemptive work of Christ. Therefore, the Passover sacrifice was a shadow of the good things to come in that it foreshadowed the redemptive work, the sacrifice, the death of Jesus Christ. So point number five in this is it was a shadow of the death of Christ. You have those four preceding points, all of which can be verified by Scripture. And now once we know that Christ, our Passover, has been sacrificed, we see now in looking back, point number five, it was all along a picture, a shadow of the sacrifice, the ultimate sacrifice of Jesus Christ. Now, by comparison, let's look at the memorial of Christ's death as it is given to us in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. 1 Corinthians chapter 11. We could go back through the gospel accounts of when Jesus gave the bread and the wine to the disciples and said, "Do this in remembrance of me." But here the Apostle Paul in chapter 11 pretty well summarizes it. And we understand from this, and by putting this side by side with the gospel narratives, this was not something that was done only on that one occasion in the night that Jesus was betrayed and was not to be repeated thereafter. No, we understand from this that this was a memorial to be carried on afterward, just as the Old Testament Passover was a memorial that was to continue to memorialize the Exodus. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 23, the Apostle Paul says, "For I received from the Lord that which I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the same night in which he was betrayed," that's the 14th, the night of the 14th, same night in which he was betrayed, "took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, 'Take, eat, this is my body which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me.'" Meaning, do this as a memorial. "In the same manner, he also took the cup after supper, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood. This do, as often as you drink it,'" meaning as many times as you drink it, whenever you drink it, or when you do it in remembrance of me. Do it as a memorial. "For as often, or many times as you eat this bread and drink this cup," this is not a comment on how frequent it was to be taken, it just means whenever or as many times as you do take it throughout the course of your life, then you do proclaim the Lord's death till he comes. So it is clearly, from this we see clearly it is a memorial of the death of Jesus Christ, a memorial of his self-sacrifice. And I'll comment a little bit more on that in a few moments about what that sacrifice consisted of, and we'll see that there was a fundamental difference between the Old Testament shadows and types and the actual reality, keeping in mind that a shadow gives you an image, an outline, but does not fill in all the details. When the reality comes, we see that the reality fills the shadow, and at the same time, within, we see the details that are not revealed in the shadow. So we'll look at that later. But for now, it's just important for us to realize that this is a memorial. What some call the Lord's Supper or the New Covenant Passover, whatever name you want to attach to this commemorative occasion that we'll be observing on the night of the 15th of April, we realize that it is a memorial. Now, 4 points here. Number one, what we're going to be doing on April 15th, number one, does not involve an animal sacrifice. No animal sacrifice is involved. Of course, you couldn't have a Passover anciently without an animal sacrifice. And the Jewish Seder service today, technically, though they may have a leg of lamb or whatever, it is not a sacrifice, and they will tell you it's not a sacrifice, because that can only be done in Jerusalem with an officiating priesthood and a temple, or some kind of something that stands for a temple, something that stands for a central place of worship. So it does not involve an animal sacrifice. Number two, it is not a memorial of the Exodus, but is a memorial of Christ's death. Number three, it is for the baptized, whether they have been physically circumcised or not. It doesn't matter. We're talking about the bread and the wine. We're not talking about the Old Testament Passover. It is for the baptized. Whether they've been physically circumcised or not makes no difference. Number four, it will be properly observed in many different locations all around the world, not just in one single sanctuary area. In some cases, even in the homes of individuals, but not in one central location. So it's a universal thing now. What we are doing, or what we will be doing on the night of April 15th, technically speaking, is not the Passover. As I've said, the Passover is a sacrificial rite, and if you take the text literally, if you look at what God's law says, it requires physical circumcision, have to do it in the central location with officiating priesthood. He doesn't say that in the text, but we understand that it's a given, the officiating priesthood that God puts there in place. But here, we see that we're not doing any of that. Therefore, what we're doing is not, technically speaking, Passover. It is a memorial. Now, get this. It is a memorial of the event that was foreshadowed by the Passover. You see, you have the shadow, and then you have the actual event, and then you have the memorial. And as we look at, as we memorialize or commemorate the actual event that was foreshadowed by the Passover, we see details there that could not be seen before. Maybe little glimpses in prophecy and so forth revealed it, but there are details there that couldn't have been known clearly before. The memorial of Christ's death is, to be sure, rooted in the ancient Passover. But you know, it is also connected with other Old Testament sacrifices. You know, we call it the Passover, and that's fine. That's fine. That's perfectly all right. Call it the Passover, New Testament Passover, Lord's Supper, anything you want to call it. We know what we're talking about, don't we? But it is also connected with, it has roots extending into, if you want to put it in that language, other Old Testament sacrifices. Let me show you what I'm talking about. Look at Matthew chapter 26. We also read it here in 1 Corinthians 11, but let's go back and see one of the gospel narratives here in Matthew 26. See what Jesus says here. It says, "And as they were eating, Jesus took bread, blessed, and broke it, and gave it to his disciples, and said, 'Take, eat, this is my body.' Then he took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you, for this is my blood of the new covenant." Some translations, I should say some of the ancient manuscripts do not have the word new there. It says, "This is my blood of the covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins." Now, where do you suppose this language comes from? This is the blood of the covenant. Well, go back to Exodus chapter 24. Exodus chapter 24, and let's see what God reveals through Moses here. And beginning in verse 3, this is when once God had given the law to the people, he had set forth the terms of the covenant. And now he said, verse 3 says, "So Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the judgments, and all the people answered with one voice and said, 'All the words which the Lord has said, we will do.'" So they're agreeing to the terms of the covenant. "And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord, and he rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. Then he sent young men of the children of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord." Yeah, burnt offerings, peace offerings. Remember, the sacrifices had already been done in Egypt. Here they're offering burnt offerings and peace offerings. "And Moses took half the blood and put it in basins, and half the blood he sprinkled on the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, 'All that the Lord has said we will do, and be obedient.' And Moses took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, and said, 'This is the blood of the covenant, which the Lord has made with you according to all these words.'" When Jesus took the cup, he said, "This is the blood of the covenant." What's he obviously referring back to? The covenant ratifying sacrifice involving burnt offerings and peace offerings that was offered here when the people agreed to the terms of the covenant. So the point I'm making is that the Passover, what we call the Passover, the Lord's Supper, the commemoration of Christ's death, when they take the bread and the wine, that it has roots extending into more than just the ancient Passover. It takes in elements of all the Old Testament sacrifices. So both the Passover and the covenant ratifying sacrifice, as well as all the other sacrifices that are named in the Old Testament and described for us, were fulfilled in the once-for-all sacrifice of Jesus Christ. That includes burnt offerings, it includes peace offerings, sin offerings, trespass offerings, and meal offerings, all of them. And if you go back and study the offerings carefully and then read through the gospel narratives and understand what all is said about Christ, you will see how all of those offerings in one way or the other point to the once-for-all sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And so the elements that we take, the bread and the wine, actually draw more. It's not just the Passover. It draws from other sacrifices as well, including these that I've just named. So you could say that this memorial that we will be observing soon represents not only Christ, our Passover, and he's called that in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, but also Christ, our sin offering, and Christ, our peace offering, and so on and on it goes. So what we're going to be doing, the point is, it's more than just a kind of a reiteration or kind of a shuffling of the symbols of a modification of the Passover. Much more than that. Now, why the night of the 14th, Nisan 14, which this year falls on April 15th in the evening? Why Nisan 14? Well, we're told in the Old Testament that the 14th day of the first month in the evening, Ben Ha Arbiim, between the two evenings, the Passover was to be sacrificed. We understand it was eaten that night. Now, as I said earlier, Ben Ha Arbiim is interpreted differently. Some take it to mean twilight, from sunset to dark. Some took it in ancient times to mean from the afternoon, about 3 p.m. to sunset. By the time of Jesus, the latter reckoning was generally understood. To my knowledge, neither the Pharisees nor the Sadducees disagreed with it. I'm not really sure. They had a number of disagreements. But in any case, it does appear that they did offer the sacrifices, the Passover sacrifices, beginning at about 3 p.m. Also, the daily evening sacrifices were offered normally at that time. And as I understand it, according to Alfred Edersheim, on the day the Passover was sacrificed, the evening moved up to 2 o'clock. Because in order to get all that sacrificing done, you had to have time to do it. If you waited around till sunset, then started, you're not going to be finished by dark. So they had the authority, as I understand it, they had the authority to determine when the starting point would be if it was not clearly defined by the term Bincha or Bim. They understood between the two evenings, so they began the sacrifice of the Passover at about 3 p.m. And it was concluded by about 6 p.m., as I understand it. Many, many, many sacrificial animals, they came through one after the other, I suppose several lines. I don't know how it was done precisely. Probably there are different accounts of that. I'm not sure. But in any case, they started about 3 p.m. and it continued on until sunset. And then, of course, the people prepared their sacrifice and it was eaten that night in what is called the night to be much observed. Now, for 20 years, we of the Church of God International have understood the expression 14th day of the month in the evening to mean the latter part of the 14th. That's when Christ died. And it is when the Passover and evening sacrifices were offered. The Passover lamb, then, was eaten that night, as I mentioned, in the night we call the night to be much observed, the 15th. For this reason, some people observe, you know, you've heard, I'm sure most of you have heard about the 14th versus 15th controversy. Some people want to take the emblems of Christ's sacrifice in the 15th. You say, why do they want to do that? And the answer is because they recognize that the ancient Passover was eaten in the 15th. Therefore, they attempt to align the memorial of Christ's sacrifice, recognizing he is the true Passover, the true Lamb of God. They try to align it with the time of the ancient Passover. The failing is this. They keep confusing the memorial of Christ's sacrifice with the Passover. And really, it is not the Passover. Again, it's okay to call it Passover because it has roots in the Passover, but as we can see, clearly it has roots in other offerings as well. And it is a distinct memorial that was established not in the time of Moses, but in the time of Christ. He established it. It was new on the night of his betrayal. It was instituted at that time. Now, in the memorial, we not only remember the moment of Christ's death. Now, this is very important. This comes to a very important distinction between the substance or the reality and the shadow. Remember, as I said a little while ago, the shadow gives you the basic outline. We look back in the Old Testament, we see those offerings being offered, and we see Christ everywhere, pictured in a shadowy way. We see Christ pictured in the priesthood. He's the high priest. He's the burnt offering, the whole burnt offering, consumed on the altar, as it were, as a sacrifice. The smoke ascending to God, that pictures the ascension of Christ. He's now in heaven with God, and his role as high priest continues. So you see, in all the sacrifices back there, you see Christ being depicted. We see him definitely in the Passover sacrifice, the blood of the Lamb. Just as death passed over the Egyptians, I should say the Israelites, death passes over us because of the blood of the Lamb. So we understand all of that. We've got that. But there's a difference now. Once the reality has come and we see Christ, we don't see him literally, you know what I mean, we comprehend him because of what is revealed, we see that there were some things that perhaps were not seen, or definitely were not seen in the sacrifices, alluded to in prophecy, as we'll look at in a few moments, but not seen clearly in the sacrifices. And you know, when they took those animal sacrifices, when they selected them from the flocks and from the herds, they found the male without blemish, or whatever type of sacrifice was being offered. It was a something, whatever it was of the best. And when they offered it, they didn't first tie it to a stake and whip it. They didn't hurt it. They didn't mistreat it. Actually, a sacrifice, an animal that was killed, and I know it to us it seems kind of all those animals being slaughtered, I really wouldn't want to watch little lambs being taken in like that, one after the other, and bleeding, and sounds like they're begging, and they slit their throats. But you know, in reality, it's a relatively painless death. Quickly slitting the throat with a sharp blade, they quickly bleed to death, and relatively little pain. Christ's sacrifice is fundamentally different in precisely that regard. For you see, His sacrifice includes His suffering. And without His suffering, we have an incomplete sacrifice. He came into this world not only to die, to slip away into unconsciousness, not only to close His eyes and in death, but to suffer on our behalf. So when we come together on the 14th, we commemorate not only what happens the following day when Christ died, not only His death, the moment of His death, but we also commemorate His passion in the garden, what He must have felt when He was betrayed by His own friend, when His disciples left Him, the sweating of blood, as it were, the scorn, the ridicule, the scourging He endured, the crown of thorns, the carrying of His cross, being held down as spikes were pounded through His flesh, lifted up with two criminals to have people scorn and ridicule and hurl insults. So it was not just the moment He yielded up the Spirit that we're commemorating. We commemorate the whole sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And you know, it's so appropriate that we do this in the night of the 14th, for the very reason that that's when that final offering, that sacrifice, His suffering began, that very night, the night He instituted the memorial of His death. Now, as I said, we do find a glimpse of this in prophecy, even though it's not spelled out in the animal sacrifices, because obviously God is not going to have the Israelites hurt those animals and mistreat them and abuse them before being killed. But we do find something in prophecy that alludes to the kind of sacrifice that Jesus Christ would offer. Christ our Passover, Christ our sin offering, Christ our peace offering. We read about it in Isaiah chapter 53, among other places, but this is one of the most descriptive here. Isaiah chapter 53, speaking of the servant we recognize to be the sin-bearing servant who is Christ. In verse 3, it says, "He is despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from Him. He was despised, and we did not esteem Him. Surely He has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed Him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace was upon Him. And by His stripes we are healed." By His stripes we are healed. That certainly takes in more than the moment of His death. It takes in His whole sacrifice, which involves His suffering, His passion in the garden, the carrying of his cross, the rejection of His own, the crown of thorns, the ridicule, the scorn, all the things He had to face. That's a part of His sacrifice. And that's what we're memorializing, His whole sacrifice, when we come here and take the bread and the wine in memory of Him. We like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on Him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and He was afflicted, yet He opened not His mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before the shearers is silent, so He opened not His mouth. He was taken from prison and from judgment, and who will declare His generation? For He was cut off from the land of the living. All this suffering, all that He endured, led to that, His death. But there's some good news here, kind of tucked in the verses. You may not notice it, If you were living before the time of Christ, you might not get it. It says, "For the transgressions of my people he was stricken, and they made his grave with the wicked, but with the rich at his death, because he had done no violence, nor was there deceit in his mouth. Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He has put him to grief. When you make his soul an offering for sin," there he is, the sin offering, "he shall see his seed. He shall prolong his days." In other words, he will rise again. And indeed he did. "And the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. He shall see the labor of his soul and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant shall justify many, for he shall bear their iniquities." So you see, when we come here on April 15th, and when we stoop down and wash each other's feet, hopefully imitating the humility that this man, this righteous servant, took upon himself, the one who came down, who emptied himself of the divinity he had, of the divine privileges he had with the Father before the world was, who made himself a servant and stooped down and washed his disciples' feet. When we take the bread and the wine, this is more than merely a continuum of an ancient sacrificial rite. We are remembering, by way of a commemorative occasion, the event that was foreshadowed by that ancient rite. In fact, an event that was foreshadowed by all the sacrifices of the Old Testament. Jesus Christ, our Passover, has been sacrificed for us. So let us, therefore, keep the feast, not with the old leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth.